Are you a scaling SaaS founder?
Ready to make the leap from leading a team to leading an organization? Join us each week as we refill your think tank with actionable tips and strategies from great business minds you know and those who don't know yet. This is SaaS Fuel with your host, five-time entrepreneur, SaaS founder, and globetrotting adventurer, Jeff Mains.
Welcome back to the SaaS Fuel podcast, where finding the right fit on our team is like choosing the perfect pizza topping. Each one adds a unique flavor, but together they create a masterpiece. I'm your host, Jeff Mains. I help B2B SaaS founders like you grow from traction to scale. Here, growth is more than just numbers. It's about crafting a future-proof company, premium valuation, and leaders who build a business of significance while living epic, adventurous lives. Friend and I were sitting around a campfire talking about business and life. We both struggle with how to keep culture strong and people connected, especially around remote teams. You know, we're both still hybrid in our businesses, and there's certainly a lot of benefits to that, and even still run into a few unknowns or awkward situations from time to time. The world has certainly changed. I think 10 years ago, and certainly 20 years ago, culture wasn't really talked about. It was just how things were at one company or another. And I remember at one place in the old days, it was a fairly militaristic culture. And the rule was you didn't leave your office without your jacket on, like a suit jacket, because we all wore suits back then. And it didn't matter if you were going to the office next door or you were going to pee, jacket on, did not matter. And there were things I liked about that place and a lot that I decided I would change in my own company and did. The jacket policy, no jackets required policy. A la Phil Collins. Well, fast forward to today, and building a great culture isn't just a nice to have. It's a make or break factor that can determine success or the downfall of a company. It's the glue that holds everything together, the secret sauce that turns a group of individuals into a high-performing team. So let's dive into why culture matters, campfire style. Yeah, how I think we get it right and wrong, along with the consequences and the benefits. Think about team fit and alignment, and imagine a rowing team where everyone is out like in sync, rowing in different directions. Or worse, maybe everybody's paddling in their own canoe. Can you imagine watching that? That actually might be a pretty good Olympic event. I'm not sure. But, you know, I've had other founders say, you know, why does it always feel like I'm herding cats? And I think that's what happens when a team lacks fit and alignment around the company's mission, vision, purpose, and core values. When leaders get it right, it's like a well-oiled machine. It's everybody rowing in harmony. You know, in sync towards a common goal. The cool thing is that that becomes part of identity. You know, they'll say, you know, we do this, you know, whatever it is, because it's who we are. Or better still, it becomes their own identity. They own it and say, I do this because it's who I am. And I think that's really powerful when they own it. It fosters a sense of belonging, increases engagement, and ultimately drives productivity. On the flip side, when leaders don't cultivate a strong culture or just take it for granted or let it work itself out, it's kind of like a ship without a rudder, just drifting aimlessly. Wherever the wind blows, that's where the thing is going. And whether you create culture intentionally or not, your company has one. And the problem is that it may not be the one that you want to be known for. Now, aimless drift leads to disengagement, high turnover, and often a toxic work environment. Kind of sucks. It's a downward spiral that can erode trust, stifle innovation, and ultimately jeopardize the company's future. As you ever work for a company like that? Probably not for long. I find that, you know, people either, you know, go there and stay there because they don't feel like they can go anywhere else, or they're just out fast. Yeah, so much turnover. So what do we do with that? What does fit look like? And I think it's important from the outside for job candidates kind of assessing culture fit, like looking for it coming in. And also for us as leaders, what do we want to do to create that culture intentionally? Well, for job candidates, culture fit is absolutely crucial. So if that's you, look beyond the job description and pay attention to how employees interact with each other. the company's approach to work-life balance, for example, and most importantly, whether the core values resonate with you. Do they even have any? And if they don't, maybe you should rethink. But for leaders, we want to make sure that we stay attuned to the real pulse of the organization. It's really difficult in a leadership position because a lot of times you only get good news. You have bad news, you know, it doesn't travel. People want to, you know, tell you that things are good. They want to tell you the good things. But open communication is so important. So encourage that. Seek feedback from all levels and be vigilant for signs of dissonance or discontent. Because if you think it's there, it's definitely there. And if you don't think it's there, it's still probably there. So pay attention to those and make sure that you're taking that feedback and doing something with it. Now, a great culture is the bedrock of a successful company. You have a company, you have a culture, and it might be the U.S. Navy or it might be a pirate ship, but it's probably somewhere in between there. But like attracts like. A great culture attracts top talent, inspires loyalty, and drives performance. And for leaders, getting it right means fostering an environment where everyone is aligned and motivated by a shared purpose. For job candidates and new hires, it means finding a place where they can thrive and contribute to something meaningful. It's something bigger than themselves. It's a win-win for everyone. Yeah, I always love asking this, what do you do to build a great culture in your business? Share your tips in the comments below. If you want to create an outstanding culture and high-performing teams, grab my book, Small Fish, Big Pond, Building a World-Class Business That Swims Circles Around Competitors. There's a chapter in there on culture along with some resources to help you do it quickly and effectively. Well, Small Fish Big Pond also delivers powerful marketing and leadership lessons guaranteed to enhance your marketing message, wrap value around your clients, and guide their buying journey to conclude that your company is the only solution for them. It includes step-by-step frameworks and time-tested growth principles to attract ideal clients, convert them, and then transform them into your brand ambassadors. Pick up the print, ebook, or audio today at smallfishbigpond.com, Amazon, or your favorite book source. And remember, all book profits go to charity always. Our founder on Tuesday was Wes Bush, founder and CEO of Product Led. He's a best-selling author of Product Led Growth, How to Build a Product That Sells Itself. Of course, we talked about product led growth, how to do it well, where things go sideways, and what doesn't work. And our expert guest last week was Dan Belkowski, founder and chief pricing officer of Product Tranquility. Dan brought great perspective on new ways to think about pricing, especially how to price your SaaS right. And we all know it's not by copying competitors. So if you missed either one of those episodes, go back and give them a listen. My guest today is Morgan McCoy, founder of Bragg & Wright Consulting. Morgan helps employees negotiate equitable compensation and make strategic career moves, and her specialty is supporting powerful women in negotiating top dollar salaries. Very, very cool. She also advises organizations on talent management for improved culture, performance, and profits. Welcome an HR champion, Morgan McCoy. Hey, Morgan, welcome to SaaS Fuel.
Hey there, Jeff. Excited to be here today.
Well, tell me a little bit about your background, HR tech, resume design. How'd you come up with the idea for Bragg & Wright and what inspired you?
Yeah, what a great question. So I started Bragg & Wright after being unceremoniously pipped at a company in late 2022. It was before this rise of tech layoffs that we've seen. And at the time, I really just wanted to prove to myself that I could accomplish a goal since my former business had kind of come after my performance in a very visceral way. And for a long time, it felt like really shameful to admit that. But a year into building a business and being successful, I now look back on it as one of the greatest gifts that I've ever been given. And so I actually started with the resume design because I have a master's in technical communication and I've always been a document nerd. And so I actually had years of beautifully designed resumes. And I was like, hey, there's a market for these on Etsy. And so I started building all of these resume templates. And then all of a sudden people needed help filling out the resume templates. And then I thought, oh, I've got this background in HR tech and compensation. Actually, there's a lot of education here that is needed in terms of communicating to women and minorities, particularly in my market, but really all employees in general about how pay works and how to negotiate a stronger salary for themselves. And so now that is the crown jewel of what Brag and Write does. I can always help you write a kick-ass resume, but I much more love to help powerful women negotiate what they're worth.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And when you say you got pipped, explain to the audience, what does that mean? What is a PIP?
Yeah. So a PIP is a performance improvement plan. And when an employee is put on a performance improvement plan, it often means that they're not meeting the standards that the company expects of them. And historically, we've seen a lot of PIPs, especially in engineering departments. But as of the last few years, we've seen more PIPs show up in really all walks of life, and people are finding themselves pipped between layoffs as a kind of shadow layoff instead of the business doing a full-fledged layoff. So I made the decision, the personal decision, to not move forward with the PIP and instead exit the business, mostly for my sanity at the time, sure, because it was really made clear to me that there really wasn't an opportunity there for me anymore. And so I chose to move forward, and I'm so glad that I did, because I wouldn't have Brag and Write otherwise.
That's really good. I mean, you're really controlling your own destiny. So you're not, beholden to somebody else and whatever that is. That seems to happen a lot. 5 years ago, I had no idea what PIP was. And I really started to hear a lot of that over the last 4 or 5 years. And sometimes it really is trying to get improvement up. A lot of times it is a layoff without doing a layoff. Or at least it's building documentation for a layoff, and then they can get rid of people and say, oh, because they didn't meet whatever the standard is, which is sad.
Yeah. It is. And I really think it depends on the business on whether or not they're intentional about retaining you through the PIP. I'm absolutely not here to say like all PIPs are evil, but they have become a tool of lazy businesses trying to shed people. So if you're ever approached by a PIP, I recommend, can I highlight a blog that I wrote here?
Of course. We'll link it in the show notes too.
Awesome. So I specifically wrote a blog post in a therapeutic kind of way about how to handle a PIP if you are ever placed on a PIP and how to make the decision of whether or not you should move forward with that decision. It's a very, very personal decision and one that we don't get to talk about a lot. And honestly, part of the reason why I started Brag and Write, because there were no resources when it came to making these kinds of professional decisions. And I wanted a partner at that point who wasn't my mom and wasn't Reddit. And so now I really love being able to be that person for other people.
I like that. So salary negotiation is a really hot topic for you. I mean, how did you decide to focus there and help employees in negotiating equitable compensation?
Yeah, great question. So I really decided to hone down into salary negotiation, partially because I do have that background in professional compensation and corporate compensation, but also because there's a lot of career coaches out there, and you've got ChatGPT that can help you write a resume. There are tools like AI Apply that will do kind of mock interviews for you. So there's a lot of resources when it comes to the job search process, but pay is still a black box, even for businesses. And employees are really never taught about how pay works. And when I started looking into the statistics of how many women in particular negotiate their salaries, actually, studies show that only 8% of women negotiate their first salary, I started getting really concerned. And it's actually one of the compounding factors of the wage gap that women aren't negotiating for themselves. And that's not to say that women aren't keen negotiators. Studies actually show that when compared to men, when negotiating for someone else, they're as keen negotiators. But when negotiating for themselves, themselves, they often take the first thing on the table. And so that's why I even named my business Brag and Write, because I want the people that I work with to brag more about their worth, own it, and show up to a conversation and a negotiation ready to ask for that number.
Yeah, that's really good. It's interesting. I think it's always difficult to negotiate for yourself. It's a lot easier for somebody else because you're maybe a little more detached from that. But I like the name Brag and Write, because that's part of the negotiation process, is really putting themselves out there and saying, hey, look at my accomplishments. Look at the value I brought here and what I can bring to you.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why having that technically written resume is so important, so that you can brag on yourself, not only in words, but in quantitative impact. If I was going to shout out one resume tip to your audience today, I would say put one number in every single bullet point on your resume, because that is really what executive recruiters are looking for, what technical recruiters are looking for. They want to see the color and tone of the impact that you have had in a business. And the best way to do that is to talk about how much revenue you generated, or talk about the number of clients that you touched, the number of user research interviews that you did. Whatever that number happens to be, by adding that color, you are demonstrating your excellence.
So how is it that somebody should be thinking about negotiating their salary? What are the points? What are the things that they should be prepared to talk about when they go in to do that?
Yeah. I actually have a specific tool, which I can also share with you, called the salary triangulation worksheet. I like to say that you should use three different salary databases to pinpoint exactly what you want out of a salary. So going to those different databases gives you kind of the legs to stand on to figure out what your best midpoint should be. And you should go into your very first interview with that number in mind. You should know what it is, and you should ask in that first interview what the pay range is for that position. Never reveal your existing salary or any past salaries, and you don't even have to say what your number is, but you should know whether or not it aligns to the range of the position that you're applying to. So with that, I would say knowing that number, and then when you do get that offer, rejoice, feel excited, but pause, take a second, go back to your salary triangulation and ask yourself, does it match what I was looking for? Am I getting an offer that is in line with what I know I'm worth in the market? And really, that's your point to ask for a counter offer from your current employer, to seek other offers. That's really the negotiation sweet spot. So don't get so excited in that moment of offer that you take that first thing on the table. Rather, take a second to evaluate your situation and ask yourself what you really want.
That's really, really good. So a lot of the listeners are leaders, founders that are doing the hiring. What are things that we should be thinking about when we're interviewing candidates?
Yeah, great question. I think that when you're interviewing candidates, know how you're going to respond to salary asks. Like, if somebody asks what the pay range is, are you going to be able to clearly enumerate what that number is, or are you going to have to say, you know, I'll get back to you? In 8 states right now, it's a legal requirement for a salary range to be posted. And it's really important that transparency is available, I think, across the nation. And that's going to tell your potential candidates how serious you are about paying them equitably, which is, I think, number 3 on the last list that I saw of, you know, desires of high profile candidates.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so what should we be thinking about? We go in there, we give a range. Are there specific things we should be looking for in you know, a well-written resume versus, you know, what a lot of resumes come in are not that great? And how should we evaluate that in light of accomplishments and candidates?
Yeah, I like to see how people are talking about their experiences. And specifically, this is maybe a little controversial, but I like to see how they mitigated risks or how they failed somehow and came back from it. I think a story like that is incredibly compelling in a resume because it's showing that, number one, you're human, which we all are, but also how you handled a tough situation. So I would love to see more hiring managers looking for those kinds of things in a resume. But I think that it takes education of employees as well, or job seekers, to know what kind of stories resonate with an employer. If I had like an ask to make of hiring managers, you know, there's a lot of people looking for feedback out there right now through their hiring process or through their interviewing process. And I know that, you know, people are busy. But if somebody does reach out to you and asks for feedback, especially in this market, just a couple of words about how the interview went or opportunities for improvement can really change that person's trajectory and take them from feeling really down on themselves, maybe if they've been on the job hunt for the last year, to feeling like there's opportunity for themselves to grow.
That's really good. So how can we employers present that and really show them the opportunity to come in and be able to grow? What does that look like?
I think just a couple of sentences saying like maybe how you as a hiring manager felt in the interview, if there were any things that the person should know as far as their body language. That's something that I see when I'm doing mock interviews with candidates a lot, where they'll hunch their shoulders or even the camera will be pointed away from them. So in this virtual world, being mindful as a candidate of how you're presenting on a screen. And then as a hiring manager, you know, doing that one extra email to say, hey, Jeff, you weren't the right candidate for us specifically because we were looking for somebody with more experience in X skill set. If you were to go evaluate, I would recommend you evaluating that skill in the future.
That's really, really good. And it's really rare. So many times, I mean, even you go through the interview process and then candidates are like, I got ghosted. I don't know what happened. Yeah, there's just no feedback. So closing that loop, I think, is super, super important. That, I like the idea of doing that and giving them some feedback.
And frankly, I think that this is on the candidates as much themselves. You know, recruiters are busy, hiring managers are busy. I see a lot of folks out there kind of like taking the ghosting upon themselves. If there's just silence, then there's this mindset of, oh, well, like they never got back to me. I've started telling people, practice some tenacity here. Like push yourself, send that extra LinkedIn message, send that extra email, that extra two emails maybe, because you have to think, you have to cut through the noise of that person's very, very busy life. And it's likely not that they're necessarily ghosting you, but that you fell off of their radar. So keep going if you're a candidate. And I like to encourage people to just reach out and ask for a status.
And that's really, really good advice. Because it is easy to lose sight of that. I mean, so many things going on. It's like, oh yeah, and if that's happened before, I know that people that we wanted to hire, and a day goes by, and it's like, oh yeah, we needed to get back to them and then do it, and well, they've taken something else. So I mean, that's a really important thing to close the loop, whether you want to hire them or whether you don't. But always making sure to close that loop.
Yeah. Jeff, what do you think an employer's like responsibility is when it comes to closing that loop?
Unfortunately, I mean, legally, there really isn't one. But I think just as a human, you want to treat people like humans. You want to treat people like you'd want to be treated. You want some feedback. You want to know, hey, I interviewed, I took the time. And you want to, I think as a hiring manager and employer, you want to communicate that people are valuable. And that they took the time, you had a conversation, and even if it's a no, to be able to let them know, and you know, just again close that loop, and let them know. So I think treating them like humans, and I think that says a lot to people that you hire. I think it says a lot about the culture of the company that that you value individuals, you value your people. And so when you do that, and that's part of the just the culture of the organization, then setting that expectation with hiring managers of, look, you go through this process and you may interview, you know, 5-10 candidates, whatever it is, take 2 minutes and respond to each one of them and say, hey, it's not a great fit, and, you know, we pick somebody else or whatever it is, but just let them know. And, you know, I've done that and received, you know, thank yous back on a no, just because they had some sort of resolution to it. And, you know, resolution, and even if it's a no, is better than just wondering of, like, I don't know what happened. Is it something I said? Is it, you know, are they still, you know, just the unknown. So I think that's really important, is to treat people like people.
Yeah, you're so right, Jeff. And I love that we're having this conversation, because I think a lot of job seekers right now are feeling very alienated. And in this market, it's certainly an employer's market, especially in tech. But people who make it through these job interviews where they are getting ghosted, those are things that they're going to remember, and they're going to tell people, yes, that they were ghosted. And, you know, if somebody goes through a interview process where they really feel like they're put on the back burner, that's something that's going to, frankly, like, color the rest of their employment experience with that employer. So something that I would really want to stress is your recruiting process is part of your onboarding process. Would you treat, yes, an employee like that? So I really want to encourage, in this moment where ghosting almost feels like it's becoming the norm, for employers and hiring managers to consider, you know, how do you treat people like humans and as you would want to be treated, even in a market where it's like you're the belle of the ball, essentially.
Yes. We've tried to model. I've got a client I've worked with for probably 10 years. And they just have a fantastic process all the way through. I mean, people get to the end of it, and even when it's a no, they're like, this is the best interview experience I've ever had. And it's just like mind-blowing. It's like, I want to do that. You know, I want that to be the experience, because it you know, communicates the culture, the value. And a lot of times they may come back around. So maybe they're not a fit today, or maybe they're not a fit for the position, but they know people who would be, and maybe they will be in the future. So it's, you know, it's always a good thing to leave somebody with a positive impression.
Jeff, you're so right there. And I think that is something that I would love for employers and hiring managers to keep in mind, is how do we evolve through AI, and you know, we're seeing an increasing rate of specifically AI technology in hiring. And so there is more automation, there is less touch. Actually, with the rise of applicant tracking systems, we know that about 75% of resumes are never seen by a recruiter. They immediately get tossed in the trash. And that's why, like, you know, believe the hype or don't believe the hype on applicant tracking systems, but the fact is true. Candidates can be immediately siloed out. And I just would hope that in our future of work, we're remembering the human side, and that seems a little bit few and far between in this moment.
Yeah. So what do you think about using AI as part of the recruiting process? And then the other side, in resume writing, cover letter writing, those types of things.
Yeah. I like to think of AI as the overeager intern who can do absolutely anything, but you have to check their work before you publish it. And so whether that's in a recruiting process or in a resume writing process, in the recruiting process, I think that it's a requirement to sort through people, because businesses don't have a sourcing problem. They have a sorting problem currently. Yes. And that's why, that's why one of the absolute best ways to find a job right now is through a network, because that person that you've networked with is acting as the sorting function for the business. But if the business doesn't have a referral for that opportunity, then they have to go through those 1,000 resumes for a CSM position somehow. And turning to AI is one excellent way to do that. But I think that there can be bias introduced in AI, and that is something that I'm especially happy to see tools like LinkedIn moving away from education requirements and moving more towards skills-based hiring so that people can have a little bit more of a level playing field around skills that you can gain anywhere rather than basing entirely on where did you graduate from.
That makes sense. Yeah, it is a tough thing. You know, you post a position and literally within a couple of days, you have 500 or 1,000 resumes. What do you do? So from a candidate standpoint, what do you think about like keyword stuffing or, you know, having things like that to pass those AI challenges and get to a human versus just writing a normal kind of resume?
Yeah, I'll address white texting really quickly here. If you're not familiar, white texting is when you copy the job description and then paste it in white text at the end of your resume. That's something that I hear be thrown around quite a bit. But the AI is sometimes smarter than that. And so I have heard of resumes specifically thrown out if that is found within the resume. But when it comes to keyword stuffing, I like to use the same strategy that I hear a lot with SEO right now, which is about focusing on writing content that is relevant to your audience. And that does mean writing directly to the job description that you are applying to. And the way that I do this with my clients is we actually go through and we'll pick two or three job descriptions that they're particularly excited about in the same role, like role title, and we'll go through and highlight what are the key skills, experiences, tools, accomplishments that those job descriptions are looking for. And then we'll use those as a guide to expressly write the resume to that role. So making sure that we're telling the stories that are explicitly in the job description asked for and using that to even prioritize what goes in bullet point number one, what goes in bullet point number two. Okay, cross-team facilitation showed up 16 times across these things. So we know it needs to go first. And using the job description to write excellent resumes rather than keyword stuffing. Does that answer the question?
It does. It does. And I think that's a really good answer. And white texting, that is something that I haven't heard in a while. But that's been pretty common.
It still gets shouted out as like a way to get past the system. And I just heard from some recruiters at Reddit earlier this week, and they called it out as like specifically a bad practice. So hopefully white texting can end at some point.
Yeah, that's good. It's like, why does this resume have a third page? There's nothing on it.
I'm curious, Jeff, like what do you look for as a hiring manager and employer in an excellent resume?
A lot of the resumes that I see are not excellent. And that's funny enough. That's actually one of the things that I think is always interesting. If somebody has a really good resume, what I'm looking for are accomplishments. I want to know what they've done. I want to know how it's relevant to their role. And then the ones that, I've had some really good success with terrible resumes. I've had really good success with names that nobody else can pronounce. And so those are things that I actually look at, and especially if they have good experience. You look at that, and because I know that just knowing the marketplace, I know they're not going to get as many looks as somebody that has a really, really good resume. And a lot of times you can get them on the phone and have a conversation, and they're really, really good at what they do. They're great conversationalists. They've got very deep experience, but they don't know how to articulate it on paper. So I think, the little hack there that I look for. But the ones that are good, my expectation is they're going to be much more well put together. They know how to organize, a resume, know how to organize their thoughts into something that makes sense. And the interesting thing is sometimes they don't. Sometimes somebody else did it for them, and then they get on the call and they haven't even read their own resume.
So that's such it's a pet kind of a, like, hit or miss. Read your resume. Read it before you go into an interview. Like, know what you're going to talk about.
Right. You ask them about something on there, and they're like, "Oh, I did that." Like, you're out. I have no idea if you did or not.
Jeff, I want to jump on one thing that you said around the like unpronounceable names. Yes. As somebody who like my last name, the spelling of my last name has nothing to do with the pronunciation. Thanks, great, 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 whomever. But frankly, I'm like a white woman, and the bias can be less there. But when it comes to especially women's names, especially people of color's names, that can absolutely be a source of bias in resume. And yeah, actually there are real studies out there that show that. So that is one place where I have seen some AI come into play in really interesting and cool ways. Actually, Greenhouse, I believe, has some anti-bias functionality where the names are actually stripped from the resume. Yes. And the so employers or hiring managers can look at the resume without being biased by the name. And I think that that is a very critical element. If we're going to rely so heavily on AI to sort out our people, we have to acknowledge that there is bias in AI and actively fight against it with tools like that.
I think that's really, really smart, is just to remove that. And you're actually looking at actual qualifications, not looking at it and going, well, you know, this name is something, so they're going to be something else. And whether it's conscious or unconscious, I think that a lot of us think that we're not biased at all. And of course we are. We may not realize it, but we all have those things that we look at. And we make judgments on all sorts of things all the time. So I like the idea of it being removed.
Yeah.
But it's part of what we are. But when you take that out of the equation, and now you're actually comparing credentials, you're actually comparing experience, I think that puts on a much more level playing field, which is helpful for everyone.
Absolutely. So, Jeff, how are you using AI in your like hiring or talent collection?
We did that with our candidate management system. And so it actually, based on the job description, it is looking for like a percentage match of the description and what we're looking for and what it finds in the resume. And so that's one of the first way that we, you know, pare down from, you know, 500 resumes to 20, and then individually reviewing those 20 and actually looking, you know, is it relevant experience?
I love that. And it's showing the power of having a specifically targeted resume to the accomplishments that the hiring team is looking for.
And that the crazy thing is, it's something that most candidates won't do. And so when there's a really high match, I think that's a really good signal, because it's probably a resume of, you know, one. And they actually took the time, read the job description, there's interest there, and they actually put some time in. It's not an accident that they have a really high correlation with what we're looking for in their experience. And I think just them taking that time, and it's not just a cookie cutter approach of, you know, I wrote a resume and I'm going to send it out to, you know, 500 companies and we'll see what happens. And that's something that most candidates won't do, is actually spend the time, really read the job description and spend the time to put together a resume that reflects that experience that we're looking for.
You're so right. And I don't necessarily blame candidates, because the way that resumes are written and the technology around the technology around recruiting applications has changed so dramatically in the last year, in the last 2 years. Yeah. If somebody hasn't been on a job search in, you know, even 3 years, then the way that I would have written a resume 3 years ago, or even the last time I wrote a resume for myself, versus how I write resumes for people now, has changed dramatically. Because you used to be able to have this one resume that you sent out to everyone, and you kind of did your best to show off what you thought was relevant. But it just doesn't work anymore. You have to be more targeted to the explicit opportunity that you're looking for. And I hear from a lot of candidates that that's exhausting. They get worn out creating resume after resume after resume. But frankly, I think that as candidates, this is a muscle that we're going to have to build. I actually just saw some numbers this morning. I think it was from Forbes, around the tenure of work is shortening even further.
Wow.
It used to be about 3.5 years. And in the current market, it's 12 months. And so we really can't, as employees, can no longer expect to really even be somewhere longer than 12 months. And so that's why when I work with people on their resumes, I say, we're going to change how you write resumes for the rest of your life, because you have to have a whole new education on what is needed in a resume, and it has to be targeted to the opportunities that you're looking for.
Now, that's really, really good advice. What do you think about resumes that you, like you said, put numbers in there? I think that's really good. And just from my perspective, I think sales hires are some of the most difficult to make because they all have numbers. I've never seen a sales resume where they weren't number one in something and just awesome. And then hire them and most of the time they're not. Not always.
Yeah.
But how do you define, you know, what's real and what's not? How do you separate fact from fiction in the numbers?
Yeah, great question. This is where, you know, it's hard as an employer because you can never fact check these numbers. You can never go in and say like, oh yes, they were really the number one salesperson on the East Coast for this business. Like that's just never going to be.
Especially if they still work there.
Yeah. You're never going to have access to that data. So you are having to take them at face value. And frankly, I do think that there's room as a candidate to, you know, I like to call it provide directional numbers, not false numbers, but numbers that are true in context and provide that color, because sometimes you don't have the numbers, or if you don't work there anymore, they're not available. And so you can sometimes provide a number that is true and in your knowledge, but isn't the exact number of revenue generated or customers contacted, but is an estimate. Often we'll see those as like 100 plus or 200 plus, just to really add that color. But my like thought there on, you know, how do you fact check that as an employer? Ask during the interview, you know, can this person quote back those numbers to you? Have they at least done the work to read their resume to say, you know, I was number one in sales on the East Coast and I did this much money in revenue? Because if they really did that, then they'll be able to quote those numbers back to you because they'll have made money off of it. So I would really encourage hiring teams there to, you know, see how much is that person bringing those numbers into their conversation? And this brings me to the topic of metrics and discussion of metrics in an interview. This is something that I'm really hearing from recruiters right now, and why one of my favorite questions to ask in an interview is, how is my performance going to be measured so that I know that I'm making an impact? Because having that measurement of success both on your side to show that you're showing up with a data forward mindset, and on the employer side to know that this person is looking to be measured for their excellence, it is a win-win.
And that's something that employers should definitely be, you know, ready for and actually have an answer. A real answer, something that's concrete, not, you know, we want you to be a team player and want you to generate revenue but very specific things for them to accomplish. Know what success looks like.
Jeff, when you're working on onboarding a new hire, what are your thoughts on like the 30, 60, 90 day success metrics? And do you usually have specific targets for folks?
Yes. I think that's really helpful for everybody because we all want to know what success looks like. And if we can say, here's what I want you to do, here's what's expected, people rise to the expectations. They, you know, amazingly, a lot of times, I mean, they, that's exactly what they hit, and you set them higher and that's exactly what they hit. And if you give them nothing or you set them low, that's probably what they're going to hit. So I think it really helps set the direction and just, you know, this is the expectation, as we want you to be productive. We want you to do these things. And this is, you know, this is why you're here and this is how you get rewarded. And this is how it fits into the bigger picture. Because if they don't understand that, then it's going to be very difficult to be committed, to stay engaged. I think that's one of the reasons we have really low employee engagement across the country. The people don't really know what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, I think you're so right there, Jeff. And this is something that I hear from clients all the time is they don't know what they're supposed to be doing. And in this market where the layoff is over your shoulder, breathing down your neck, people are desperate to know what they can do to define their success and show their value to a business. But what we see is a lot of contradictory leadership and a lack of success metrics. And I hate to like throw back to Agile. It seems like Agile is like in its death throes right now amongst businesses, but at least Agile provided some kind of opportunity to know the flow through work. And I think that that's something that we got unplugged with through the pandemic. And now we're really reckoning with how do we work in a different way? And how do we have leaders who show up with explicit metrics so that people can meet them? What do you think about that?
I think that's really, really important. Is having those specific metrics. And you're right. A lot of that has been lost in the last few years. And you know, people who don't know what they're supposed to do or don't really know how they add value, they're not going to be engaged. They're probably going to be looking and are not going to stay long term. And then you don't know how to develop them either because you don't know, you know, what the skills are, where they want to go or what their ambitions are. So how do you create a career path without having those in place?
Yeah, absolutely. What is your business's perspective on career path, not only career pathing, but the role of education for employees at this time when we're really seeing this rise of AI and different tools that some employees have never had experience with before?
We actually have been training on AI for a little over a year, and I want everybody to be using it in their role. So not just because it's a shiny object, it can certainly be that way, but it adds a lot of value to every single role when you figure out how it can help you. You know, Copilot, I think, is one of the greatest names for an AI there is. Not necessarily the best tool, but it's pretty good. But you know, that's really what we look at it as, is a Copilot. So along with you doing your job and, you know, continuing training. I think that's something that we absolutely have to do if we want to keep people long-term is to really show that career path, show a progression, you know, show training and help them improve their skills. And of course, there's always the old argument of, well, you know, what if we train them and they leave? And you know, somebody else says, well, what if we don't train them and they stay? I'd much rather train them. And if sometimes they move on and that's part of business. You know, some of the greatest experiences I've had have been, you know, somebody moves on and they start their own company. And, you know, and it's sad in one way and it's really exciting in another. But I think we have to invest in our people and assume that they're going to be around a long time and create an environment where they want to be around a long time.
Yeah. What is your perspective on some of the like mass layoffs that are happening right now when it comes to really like not only a lack of investment in people, but also this like massive shedding of employees?
Yeah, that's been really interesting over the last year. One, they never should have been hired. And I think one of the things that we've done just as business leaders is rewarded the wrong things. And one of those in particular is team size. So you ask any manager and they're like, oh, my team is 40, 50, it's 100. And the bigger your team is, the more important you are. And I think we saw a lot of that in tech where people hired because they wanted to be more important in the organization. And so the more important people have the biggest teams. What were they doing? They didn't know. They just had body count. And so that was something that was really good. And then what happens is, you know, layoffs happen. How can you possibly get rid of 40, 50, 60, 80% of a company and it still be just fine? I mean, it's mind blowing. So, you know, what were people doing? So I think that really, it's not on the employees. It's really on the culture and the hiring managers and rewarding the wrong things.
Yeah. How have you seen your team kind of like weather this storm of hiring with thoughtfulness? And what would you recommend to other business owners?
We try to be very thoughtful about it and just very methodical. So it's, you know, if we're hiring, it's for a specific role and it's for a specific purpose. A lot of times it is taking an existing role and splitting it, or somebody moves into a different role, a different leadership position or a different department, and really try to have that career path. So we do a lot of that with they come in through support, and then they move into to other roles from there once they know the product, once you know we know them well, where their skills are. It's really having that career path. And so that's something that we've continued to do is move people into other roles from that. So there is a future, but not over hiring. I've certainly made that mistake in multiple companies where it's like, you know, we're probably going to need somebody, and we know it's going to take, you know, 3 months for them to get up to speed. So let's hire 4 of them now. And, you know, hopefully we'll keep 2 of them. And so I just, you know, kind of bad thought process in that. So I think, you know, making very conscious hires and investing in people. So, you know, it is a business that they want to stay with long term and that there's equal commitment. So it's not just them committing to the company, but it's a company committing to them.
Yeah. I love this attitude of commitment. And one thing I want to touch on is this trend of, you know, with younger generations really desiring not just like pride in their work, but feeling as though they have an impact. And this is something that I often see framed as a complaint from employers of like, oh, these youth, they want to like change the world and they want to have, you know, they want to work in nonprofits, but this is a tech business. I want to say for all of us youths out there, that's not necessarily the case. I think what people of younger generations really want is to know that their work has value and impact.
Yes.
And that really goes back to the point that we were making around having metrics, around really having clear leadership objectives around what success looks like. Because having impact can really be driving to those goals. But if there's no goals, then it's like, yeah, everybody's having a crisis because nobody knows what's going on. So I really want to encourage employers to think about like, what is your goal setting strategy and empower your employees to be a part of it. Because when you do that, people are going to be more excited to work for you and they're going to want to stay on longer and invest themselves in your business. And frankly, that's going to save you money in hiring, in healthcare costs, because they're not going to be as depressed, and in training so that you're not bleeding the brain trust of your own business.
That's really, really smart. And that's a good way to think about it. Impact is so important. And having something, you know, people do want to be a part of something bigger than themselves. You know, they want to know that what they do matters, that that they actually can change the world. And I think that's, you know, having a strong mission as a company and communicating that down and making sure that everybody knows how their role impacts that mission. So they should buy into the mission when they come on board, but then they need to know how their role makes that happen.
Exactly. And too often the mission is something that we see posted on the business's website, but then really never spoken of again. So if you're an employer out there or a business owner, you know, think about how you're communicating your mission to folks. I heard from one UX director who worked at, I believe it was Xbox a while back, that they actually printed their mission and put it on posters all across the office, which this would be hard to do in a virtual environment. But just the fact that everybody looked at the mission every single day kept everyone really on track with what they were working towards. So I think the more often you can repeat not only your mission, but your yearly goals, your quarterly goals, the more likely people are to be on track with you.
Yeah. And when you do that and you have those goals and they see that vision, it's empowering to them because they're like, I can do that. And then they do it and it just reinforces that belief and the commitment.
Yeah. And frankly, this is a nation of workaholics. Like, we want our workplace accomplishments. And so when a business can help capture that and inspire people to reach for new ideas and business transformation and business development in this moment where, you know, we are moving through the fourth industrial revolution and work is never going to look the same again with the use of AI. So how do you, as an employer, inspire people to kind of keep going and stay on mission. I don't know, Jeff, how do you inspire your employees?
I think it really is around the mission. I mean, they absolutely believe in that and in creating culture and knowing that it's not just them that's on board. I mean, one of the first core value is that we're all in together. So it's not just one person being all in, but we are all in together for each other. And it's that equal commitment. So it's not just one person that's doing it. It's all of us. And, and if one of us, you know, is not, and everybody else is, then you know, they're very much an outlier. And so it's really having that all in commitment. And I know that, you know, you've got my back, I've got your back, and we're in this together and fully committed to each other. And I think that's really important and ties right into the mission.
Yeah, absolutely.
You said, you know, we are a nation of workaholics, and I think that's very much true. Mindset well-being, something really, really important. And, you know, building your business, you've done that, but you also have time for, you know, horseback riding and dancing and your border collie, Mozzie. And how do activities like that contribute to mindset well-being and influence your approach to you know, career growth and building a business?
Yeah, what a great question. And, you know, it was funny, late last year, I had this kind of black mirror moment where I realized that I had started this business in order to, you know, become captain of my own destiny and shape my own time. And then, oh my gosh, I'm working 12-hour days. I'm chained to my computer. I have the worst boss in the world. What have I just done to myself?
Exactly, and yeah.
It really took me taking a step back and saying, this is exactly the problem that I had with the corporate culture. I'm doing it to myself. How do I be a better boss to myself and a better leader? And sometimes that means making space for you to exist as a human. So now I try to schedule time in my calendar for horseback riding. I have actually started taking my dog for a walk every morning again. Used to do that back as an employee because, you know, you're on somebody else's time. But I'm sure, Jeff, as you know, as a business owner, it's all the time. So it feels like the business is sometimes.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I actually have to shout out, I worked with a burnout coach. Her name was Adrienne Allaway, and she did incredible work with me in saying, you know, you do your best work when you are rested, rather than when you show up exhausted. It's going to take you 90 minutes to do the tasks that on a good moment would have taken you 5. And so really thinking for myself, when am I showing up the best and how am I allowing myself rest rather than, you know, not being as productive as I could be, and building back in a lunch to my day and building in a morning walk to my day when I don't have a commute, and finding those avenues of still being a human amongst being a virtual worker.
That's so good. I want to wrap up one last thing. Last time we talked, one of the things that I wrote down that you said was happy people create profitable businesses. Tell me a little bit about that. Talk to the audience. How does that work? How do happy people create profitable businesses?
Yeah, what a great kind of moment to land on here, Jeff. So when we think about the role that happiness plays in work, it actually shows up in a couple of different financial ways. So a happy person is going to cause less strain on the healthcare system or on the insurance policies that you as a business owner have. So if you have employees who aren't moving from their desks, who are depressed, who are really spending a lot of money in their healthcare, then that's going to cost you as a business. Additionally, unhappy people are going to be more likely to leave, which costs you in training. It costs you in hiring the new person, then training that new person. And then it also costs in really if then if the employee wellness doesn't bother you, then it costs you in knowledge retention. And I read a statistic not so long ago that Fortune 500 businesses lose up to $500 million a year in loss of knowledge. And so that is a huge cost that I think a lot of businesses don't consider, because when you've just like hired an entirely new employee base, no one knows where anything is at. Nobody knows your data systems. Nobody knows your structures. Nobody knows the sales process. There can be all of this knowledge loss that comes along with unengaged workers who go find a next opportunity. And if you as an employer don't care about the health and wellness of your employees, you definitely should care about how much knowledge stays in your business, because that's how your business functions.
Right, right. And that's super important. I mean, maybe if you have 50,000 employees and you lose that, then you know, at an executive level, you have no idea. But you really feel that, your first 200 employees for sure. And I think that's a really important thing to think about is making smart hires and keeping people long-term so you don't have that knowledge drain.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, really thank you good. So much for your time today, Jeff. It's just been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for being on. And where can people learn more about you and about Bragg & Wright?
Yeah, you can go on to braggandwright.com. That is braggindwright.com. And you can book a free consultation with me there directly from the website. I always give people like 20 minutes and I'll look at resumes. I'll talk to you about your job search strategy. We'll even do some like live mock interviewing in a short time. So I like to say, like, whatever moment of transition you're in, Bragg & Wright is here to support you and make sure that you get paid what you're worth.
That's awesome. And we'll make sure and link that in the blog post in the show notes as well. And triangulation.
Yes, I'll make sure that you have that triangulation worksheet.
Absolutely. Well, Morgan, it's been a great conversation. Thanks for being on SaaS Fuel.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jeff.
Thanks again, Morgan, for coming on the show and sharing your insights and resources. You know, I really enjoyed the back and forth. It was fantastic, exceptionally talented, and super helpful today. Well, you can learn more about Morgan and Bragg & Wright at braggandwright.com. And it's Bragg & Wright without a G, braggandwright.com. And of course, check her out on social as well. She does some great posts on social media. All links, highlights, resources, and full show notes. Everything we talked about is available to you at sasfuel.com. And be sure to check out our YouTube channel as well. Full episodes, shorts, outtakes, trainings, all sorts of things out there for you. So check us out on YouTube. And help a friend out while you're at it. Share this episode with someone who needs an empowerment boost today. Let's lift each other up, one podcast at a time. Everyone who shares this week gets a culture cauldron. It's a magical pot where you can mix your values, goals, and a pinch of fun to brew the perfect winning culture potion. Or just grab my book, Small Fish, Big Pond, and it'll guide you step by step. You know, if you're still listening right now and want a copy, print, ebook, audios, whatever, just go to sasfuel.com, hit the chat button down there in the bottom right, and the team will hook you up. Just tell them you were listening, and I said I'd give it to you, and we'll take care of that. And just because you're listening right now. Join us next Tuesday, where our founder is Derek Osgood, former marketing exec turned founder and CEO of Ignition, the collaborative go-to-market platform helping product and marketing teams to get new products to market faster and more effectively. And then next week on our SaaS Fuel Expert series, we have Ryan Staley, founder and CEO of Whale Boss. Ryan is a top thought leader on AI for revenue growth. We'll be talking sales, marketing, AI, and exactly what works today and why, and some bad use cases for AI also. So I'll see you next time. And as always, enjoy the journey.
Thanks for listening to SaaS Fuel. Full show notes for each episode, which includes a summary, key takeaways, quotes, and any resources mentioned, are available at sasfuel.com. Be sure to follow and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're enjoying the content and getting value from these episodes, please leave us a rating and review at ratethispodcast.com/SaaSfuel. We'll be sure to read these out on future episodes.